Welcome to episode 20 of Photo Geek Weekly. This is the podcast, hopefully you've been listening to for a few episodes, and you know that we are all about the geekiest stories in the photographic industry that I can drum up on a weekly basis. I'm your host, Don Komarechka, and joined with me as an equal or superior geek in some ways, lesser in others. Geekery is really hard to measure, but a man that I respect for his geekery with me today is Steve Brazel. And he's had me on his show of Behind the Shot before. We talked about snowflakes recently, and it was a lot of fun. And now I get to pick your brain, Steve, and I'm very excited to do that. Welcome aboard.
Thank you very much for having me, Don. And definitely not more than. I'm out of my league being in a room with you when it comes to geek stuff.
Well, thanks for being here anyhow. And I know that at least if I throw you the ball, you can bounce it back to me. And there's going to be some fun discussions that we have back and forth within that regard. But before we get into those discussions, you are a man of wearing many hats. What keeps you busy on a daily basis? And where do your passions lie?
Good question. I'm a network engineer by trade. So I for the real geeks out there, I got my original MCSE on Windows NT 3.5.1, which if you're a real geek, you'll remember that was living in a nightmare. I've been in radio for about 40 years, and I host a podcast on the This Week in Photo Network, Behind the Shot. And I'm a concert
photographer. Hold on. You just skipped over. You've been in radio for 40 years. I think you should maybe add an extra sentence at least to that. Were those 40 years just so pass overable?
No, actually, I still do it. I will never get out of it. I mostly just do weekends now because I have to make a living and there's no money in radio. But I've been at the radio station I'm at now, which is a rock station here in Southern California, since 1987. So 30 years and over almost 30 and a half years. And absolutely love radio. And that's who I do my photography for mostly, is I'm a concert photographer. I shoot rock concerts.
When you were at that radio station, I was most definitely still in diapers.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah,
and you still
have
hair.
I was a year old.
So yes, I am quite old.
Well, but you come across as being somebody that is so very with the latest and greatest of technology. And I find, people of my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, technology is a way for them to interact socially. And that's about it. I mean, they can fumble around with cameras. They can, the world is not foreign to them. But they don't even attempt to understand what's going on behind the scenes. And I think the greater understanding that we have of that sort of stuff is what lets you be your network engineer and understand where packets are going and how to organize a secure network, which by all means is unbelievably important these days.
Yeah. And the thing to me, this is the reason I love the entire concept of your podcast, right? Is because the whole thing to me from a geek point of view is what an amazing time to be alive, right? I mean, think about the stuff that we have that when I was a kid and had hair, dialing a phone for us was you spun it and then you had to wait for the ring to spin all the way back before you could hit the second phone number. We live in an amazing time now where I have to be careful how I say it, but my studio lights here, I turn on using HomeKit. I say, hey, Shlomo, set the scene to studio or set the scene to work or turn on the laundry room light. It's an amazing technology time that we live in.
And it's not just the technology, it's what we're finding uses for with this technology. It's funny because we were talking on the last episode of about storage and backup and all of those types of things. And I use a Synology NAS and I recently said, hey, there's an update. Oh, wow, you're fixing 6 security flaws. Oh, right. And they have CVE dates of 2017. So, I mean, months ago, these were at least disclosed, and now I'm finally getting patches. So, do I really want my NAS on the internet? Because who knows what security vulnerabilities are going to come out in the future? And understanding that, hey, these things need to be updated for you to stay safe and secure and to have all of your data safe and secure. Because, in this digital era right now, it can just disappear in a heartbeat. And if like my grandfather, he had all of his images on a memory card, an SD card, that it was so big that he never had to download them. So he never did. And then one day it just got corrupted.
Right.
And he gave it to me. And, you know, thankfully I was able to save it. It was just whatever the file indexing system got, you know, mushed around or something got mixed up that could be recovered by the myriad of software out there that does that thing. And so I was able to save all of his work. But what if it was the controller on the memory card that failed? Well, then you're looking at having somebody do microsurgery on a memory card to replace the controller, which is outside of the budget of anybody I know. So, you know, those images would have been lost.
Yeah. And that's one of the things is in a business world, that scenario, a company would call drive savers and send their drive off to them and spend whatever it takes because the data is that important. But we as normal humans, we use all of this data. We use all of this technology. And it is our lives. Your Synology analogy to me is one of the most wonderful things people don't think about. The fragmentation in certain things in our lives on a daily basis, whether it be Android or whatever. Those type of scenarios are part of why I choose the geek stuff that I choose, right? I want a company that I know is proactive at pushing me out updates at a point where I can install them when I want. I think that's a critical thing in understanding. The big problem, as you and I, I'm sure, will agree nowadays, is it's not us. It's the web servers that are hosting our data. It's the issues we've had with social media companies recently.
You wake up one morning and, oh, there's been a data breach at Yahoo. And, oh, everything that I've ever posted to Yahoo, every credential, they are potentially in the wild. And because at the time Yahoo owned Flickr and I was paying for an account, then my credit card information could, you know, be suspect. And, you know, that's the stuff that's really scary because no matter how much you want to have control of things, you don't.
Well, and the problem is you and I would know what to do and we know how to secure things. And I use a completely different 14 character password on every single website. Right. I use a password manager.
I should interject here and state that the password generator that I use is from GRC.com, Gibson Research. And Steve Gibson does a lot of amazing freeware, and he has a password generator of all password generators. You can choose any random character of any length. You could choose it to be alphanumeric if you want, or throwing in all of the other random characters, which is really valuable. And I've got that all in a password store here. I could never remember or type out any of those passwords, but that's not the point. I should never have to. And they are much more secure because of that. And every website uses a different one. So that if one account is compromised, then if that information ends up into the public eye or the undernet or whatever, you know, whoever gets their hands on it, they can say, okay, well, this email address is associated with this password. So let's plug this email address into every place we can find online with that password and see if we get a match. And initially, before I had this strategy involved, I had a really ridiculously random password on Twitter. But I had used that password two or three times before. And I kept getting, because of second factor authentication, I kept getting texts to my phone asking for me to authenticate the login attempt. And I'm thinking, okay, one of these three or four websites has just lost my data. I haven't heard about it from Twitter, so it's probably somebody else. And then you go and you change all those passwords. You know, it's the digital era. We have to act accordingly.
Well, and you mentioned Steve Gibson, who is a guru when it comes to security. His podcast Security Now on Leo Laporte's network is phenomenal. But one of the things that always cracks me up, again, being a network guy, is the one password most people think, well, I don't need to worry about that one. I never actually type it, is their email password. And I try explaining, the most important password you own is your email password.
Especially if you are connected to your email server in the clear.
But if most people use for their online bank that email address, and it's the same email address they reuse. So if I go to the bank and say, if I get control of your email password and your email, I can just go to your bank and say, hey, I'd like to reset my password. And guess what? I intercept the email that comes.
Yep.
So security Security matters.
Security most certainly matters in our digital era. And I'm glad we had that little interlude at the beginning of this episode. But let's get into our first story, which I find totally geeky, not 100% understood, but we might kind of read the tea leaves and figure it all out through this discussion. We come back to Red, the cinematic camera company, and they also have a smartphone that is currently on pre-order by myself because I'm very keen to see what they can do with the 3D tech that they're bubbling into that. But they have a deep space sensor called the Gemini 5K that I'm guessing was contracted by NASA or some other space governing body. NASA's kind of what comes to mind, that made a very specific sensor that now they've repurposed and they've rolled into a commercial product. So you can get this inside of a Red body and general release like today. It's available. You can buy it and they'll ship it out to you, which is phenomenal to say the least, that, you know, its availability is so quick. And the cost, I mean, it's not beyond what you would expect to be paying for a Red camera body. It's, what was it, $24,500?
It's $24,000. That's the Epic W body with that sensor, the body and that sensor in it. And if you know anything about Red, $24,000 is not much to begin with.
I mean, you've probably already invested in this platform if you're looking at this. You've already got all of the extra bits and pieces. You see these Red cameras on set, or I've seen them when I've been filming documentaries. And just the body and the sensor, that is just a small piece of the whole contraption that builds up around that. And it's beautiful to see, as complex as this sort of Lego piece kit evolves and somehow always interacts perfectly together.
Well, and to put it in perspective, this technology with this sensor, which we'll get on the details here in a second, but $24,000 in that industry, I mean, if you're shooting movies, it was not long ago that you were buying $100,000 cameras, right? $24,000 is nothing to get what this does. But it's interesting because you mentioned you think it's NASA. We don't really know where the Gemini 5K S35 came from, but it is a 5K sensor. And here's the thing that stuck out to me of all the things. First of all, it apparently originally was just an extreme low light sensor. They've now made it dual ISO. So it has a standard mode and a low light mode that can be switched in real time. No reboot needed. But here's what stuck out at me. The standard mode gives you 16 and a half stops of dynamic range in a video camera. Wow.
16 and a half stops. I mean, I'm letting that sink in because you look at even the best still cameras out there and you'd think a still camera could beat that. But that is, I mean, that is cutting edge. Once this gets reviewed by DxO Labs for the accuracy and the truth behind the marketing claim of that, I'm sure it'll match because they haven't lied about that stuff in the past. What was interesting, though, is when you switched it into the high ISO mode, it gives it about a two-stop advantage, from what I could say. Like ISO 800 in one mode becomes the equivalent in terms of noise and detail as ISO 3200 in the regular mode. So the new mode is much, much better in the low light performance, but it also clips the highlights higher. And I couldn't quite understand exactly what they were doing between these two modes. And I think that they are intertwined in some way that will limit the total dynamic range when you go into that high ISO mode in a way that I don't think is going to be detrimental to the work, but it's still there.
But therein lies a question I'm wondering if you know the answer to, and that is, if you switch into the low light mode, you get less dynamic range. Right. So you can shoot at 3200 and it's the equivalent of shooting at 800. But why would they need to cap the DR? Why? What is the reasoning for that?
I think this has to go back to the way that they do an analog to digital conversion of the signal. And it's the same reason, I think, somewhat mired in mystery as to why some cameras are ISO invariant and others are not. There's something happening in the conversion of the signal to a digital signal that certain Fuji cameras, certain Sony cameras will have the ability to say, set the ISO at 100. Versus 3200 and have the shutter speed and aperture the same. And if I were to take that ISO and drag that slider all the way up, that exposure slider in Lightroom or other any other software, to the equivalent of ISO 3200 on the lower one, then I get the same results. But on the higher ISO image, my highlights are gone. I can't recover them. But on the lower one, they're there. So I think that this might be some sort of ISO invariant variant. That, again, I don't have all the puzzle pieces to fit together here, but it's a wonderful piece of kit, because for documentary filmmakers that are often working in low light scenarios, that they can't add in extra light. They're not in a studio that they have control over. This can be a game changer. This can really, add extra storyboards to the narrative that weren't possible before, and to get the footage as one would be expected. I'm currently shooting footage for documentary films, but the footage that I'm gathering cannot be gathered on film. It cannot be gathered continuously. It has to be gathered as still frames that are very lengthy exposures that are then put together as video feed afterwards because of the extremities of the light requirements needed for this. And so I've got hardware from Cognosys. They make the StackShot, which is an automated focusing rail. And they've got a rotational platform as well. So I can rotate an object and move the camera slightly forward and back to kind of pull focus and rotate and do motions, and then take a 30-second exposure and then do the exact same thing again with like a 1 degree of rotation or a very slight movement forward or backward to gather 300 or 400 frames that then goes together to become a couple of seconds of video. Right. And that sucks. That's really hard to do. And I'm not saying that this Red camera is going to supplant the current gear that I have. It's a step in that right direction, but it's another tool in a cinematographer's tool belt.
Well, and at 16 and a half stops, you know, people debate, because obviously everybody's human eye is different, and it depends on the ambient light and everything in the room, glasses, et cetera. But in theory, the human eye on an average is 20, 24 stops. So from a motion picture point of view, from a motion film point of view, digital film, this is like seeing in the dark. Like you say, for documentary filmmakers, this will be absolutely insane. The way they're doing it apparently is, like as you would expect, the actual pixels on the sensor are larger. So you're going to get less noise. You're going to get more resolution out of it. The sensor itself is only 15.4 megapixels, but it's a 5K camera. It's 5120 by 3000.
Yeah, and I crunched the numbers that it's about the same pixel size as my 1DX Mark II. Which is a slightly larger sensor, and it has 20 megapixels. So, you know, I love that camera because bigger pixels mean better results in general. I mean, it's right. always a rolling target from one generation of cameras to the next. But, you know, you see this and you see this beautiful product that now cinematographers can have. But I got to go back to the origin story here, because how on earth could the product development be funded by the production of maybe a handful of cameras for what they're saying is deep space photography? And I can't see that being done terrestrially, because you would do techniques like I just described, using still frames and putting that together in terms of video, and you'd get generally better results. You don't necessarily need to do that in real time. Okay, so then you see all the footage of people on the International Space Station. Well, inside the station itself, they got a lot of light. They don't need to have any special cameras there for that purpose. But what if somebody's going out on a spacewalk, right? What if somebody is EVAing with a camera or potentially taking it to another location beyond that, somewhere, beyond the planet? What if the next Mars rover has a Red camera on board?
I was just going to say that one, actually, because that's, first of all, Red cameras aren't that big. You could easily, the Mars rover right now has, I was going to do on my show an interview with somebody who took a selfie of the Mars rover. They're the camera operator for two of the cameras. But you could put these on that, or like you say, somebody could leave the space station and shoot in space. I just interviewed a guy by the name of James Nyehouse, he's a cinematographer. He shot the first ever IMAX film that was nominated for an Academy Award. It was the Mount St. Helens eruption. And he's the guy who teaches astronauts and cosmonauts how to shoot IMAX film in space, which tells me they're shooting high-res film somewhere in space, right? They don't need, doesn't need to be inside the space station. So I can definitely see this being used in the right scenario. There's one thing they talk about in the article, and I'm not a videographer. I don't, I'm horrible at video. I don't understand the technical aspects of video very well. Why on earth are they using this phrase as a marketing term? 300 more vertical pixels for better resolution in anamorphic use.
Maybe a cinematographer knows exactly the answer, and this has been just totally tickling their interest the entire time, and this is what they've been waiting for under the Christmas tree for years. But it seems weird, because if that's the case, it would have been done already.
Well, an anamorphic film is a specific ratio to begin with. It's 235 to 1, 185 to 1, whatever it is. I don't know why you would add more pixels to a vertical.
Yeah, I can't explain that. It doesn't improve the quality by any measure. And to make it a marketing point, I would think that that would be something like way, way down in the bullet points of, and we do this, and there's like 20 lists, and it's one of those little items. I wouldn't have expected it to be such a big thing, and I'm really curious as to why. I think it means that the sensor was built to the spec of somebody else, and this was just one of the lines on their items, and they had to accommodate for that. I was kind of joking when I said a Mars rover camera, because I know that those sensors, they've got to be hardened to the radiation of space, much more so than a camera that's up at the International Space Station that can be replaced on the next resupply mission. I know that the Mars rovers, I think they're at 2 megapixels as for their cameras, and they do grid panoramas to increase that and everything, but they are hardened to gamma ray and other exotic ray radiation, and that means the resolution has to be lower, the features have to be lower. I don't think, although I would love to say that RED has kind of accomplished a space-worthy camera that could, be fitted on the next space probe that flies past Pluto. But when you spend that amount of time in space, you have to have a very specific design that is not affected by all of the stuff that we don't care about here on Earth.
But this camera this sensor at least, very clearly was designed with a very limited market in mind. This thing is so unique in what it is built for. Okay, they're taking a commercial sensor, clearly, and they're repurposing it to try and gain money on a consumer end, professional end. But it was built for a specific commercial purpose. It had to be.
Yeah.
And that's the question someday I want to know is what was.
Let's hope they come out with more details on this, because that behind the scenes view, the under the hood conversation, I think that's what we're all geeking out about here, and we don't have all the answers. So let's hope that comes. I might, bug RED to see if they'll give me any further details, although I'll probably get a press release as an answer. But hey, it's fun to talk about this stuff at the very least. We live in interesting times in many ways. If we go on to the next story, because one of the things that I have been, participating in, but also very cautious of in the past few years, are photo contests. And there have been a number of them that I've judged, that I've helped run, and they have been great successes. But if you look online for photo contests, there are a ton of them. Let's say the International Photographer of the Year. How about the Monochrome Awards, ND Awards, Fine Art Photography Awards, Monovisions Photography Awards? Well, if you've heard of any of those, I'm sorry for you if you entered, because there is a very good chance that either your photo wasn't judged appropriately or you have absolutely no feather in your cap as a result for winning anything from these contests. Steve, you know this article that I'm talking about. Why don't you lead this one out?
So you mentioned a number of contests, and in the research, basically what they found was, and this is an article on Petapixel, one of my favorite websites, actually. What they found was many of those contests had one man in common. Like I think of him as the International Man of Mystery. And all the judges, they contacted judges for a number of these contests, and the judges said, even though an award had been given out, they had not judged one image.
And they hadn't been asked to judge.
Yeah,
they had no affiliation whatsoever.
some of them didn't even know their name yet was being used. And the IPOTY, the International Photography of the Year contest, the monochrome contest, they're estimating that they may have made on submission costs for entering these contests, because these are all pay-to-play contests, somewhere between $130-ish and $220-ish thousand dollars. The contest winners got, you know, like 700 or 7,000 or something, you know, relatively small. So somebody is making a lot of money, and it appears to be a guy by the name of Martin Stavers. Seems to be connected. And it was interesting. This is where the geek part of this comes in. The way they figured out who it was, they started looking at these websites and traced back the IP address to find that every one of the domains was on the same server.
Yep.
Then his name popped up somewhere, and when they checked his name and his domain name for a contest that he had advertised being an owner of and a part of, it was on the same IP address. Just a lot of weird coincidences.
A lot of fun behind the scenes stuff. And as a network guy, I figure you would appreciate this particular story, because a little bit of sleuthing work needed to be put into play here to figure out that this guy, Martin Stavers, or Stavars, or however you pronounce his name, he has been running photo contests and a lot of contests. There might be more that we don't know about, but at least this many of them. And he's made himself a millionaire probably a few times over, because these contests have run for many years. And he's probably paid out a couple of $1,000 here and there for winning a contest, which is pennies on the dollar compared to what he was pulling in. And a successful scam, if you keep it upright, you know, if you keep bringing in the judges, maybe you hire somebody to start managing this and to do it properly. But as all thieves get lazy, as time goes on, he just stopped even bothering and thinking, hey, you know what? This cash cow is just going to keep on flowing. I just got to make the pages look legit and people won't notice. Well, we've noticed. And the industry is now taking a more fine-tuned look at other contests around the web, because not only are some contests like this one not worth your time or money to enter, because winning them doesn't really mean anything. But I've reviewed contests in the past, and I pulled up some text from a presentation that I give to my students. And here's a contest from On The Go Tours. It was a fairly big tour company. And in their terms and conditions, and please read the terms and conditions, especially as it relates to your copyright and the rights that you give right. The people that are running the contest. I don't want to drag it on. I'll just read the salient point here. But it says, by participating in this contest, contestants waive all claims to intellectual property rights in the entry, including trademark, copyright, and patent rights. Well, I don't think anybody has trademark and patent rights on their average photographs, but the copyright goes to the contest. So by simply entering, not by winning, not by being shortlisted, but just by submitting your photograph, you no longer own it. Legally, you can't have a copy of it on your computer. You can't print a copy of it. You can't display a copy of it. Those rights are no longer yours.
Yeah, you can't even put it on your Instagram account at that point. You'd be violating, I mean...
Exactly. And if somebody were to file a copyright claim against you, they'd win. As absurd as that sounds, and I know a lot of these rights are overreaching, they're draconian, and people don't even realize some of this language is in there. I remember my own city, the city of Barrie, ran a photo contest a few years ago, and I wrote to them, and I said, your terms and conditions, if anybody actually understood what they were giving you, they wouldn't submit a single photograph. So if you wouldn't mind revising these paragraphs, and by the way, here are the revisions I suggest you use. It gives you all the rights that you need to run the contest, but you're not over grabbing. They actually revised the rules. They changed the rules. I submitted photos to the contest and I won. I don't know if there's any favoritism there. I hope there wasn't, but I did submit some pretty good photos and I won that contest, but I wouldn't have submitted it the way the rules were. And I've got this other contest from nature.org. And the salient points in this one is they specifically state you will retain all the rights to any photograph you submit, including ownership if applicable, provided images to other individual organizations that are nonprofit, nature conservancy related in news stories, newsletters, reports, slideshows, displays, web pages, and the like. They really spell it out that these images could only be used in these specific scenarios. And that's great. I love when people are specific about that. And then at the end, it says the Nature Conservancy shall credit all photographs with the caption copyright person's name when the full name is available, or by their Flickr username. I guess they were running this through Flickr as well, when the participant's full name is unavailable. So they specifically state you get all rights, you get all credits, and we have limited uses, and these are those uses. If you're going to enter any photo contest, the very first thing you should do, well, avoid the few that we mentioned to begin with. The next thing is check the terms and conditions and make sure that they're in your favor, and then consider running. You know, I run a pay for play contest through Outdoor Photography Canada magazine, and it's not a huge fee, and you get 10 images that you could submit. And they get featured in the magazine if you win, or you get an honorable mention. And so you get into a publication as an amateur for a very nominal fee. And I know that some of that money from that competition goes to supporting the website itself, to pay the contributors of the magazine, because magazines are not necessarily in the greatest shape these days. So, you know, it helps the production of that. It doesn't just all go into one greedy person's pocket, which is definitely something I would like to avoid.
Well, and really what this comes down to, by the way, it's really funny. This guy, he's 37, something like that. He was born in Poland, but lives in London now. He's denied it. So this is alleged, right? But the sleuthing seems to strongly indicate one of the pages was only removed 2 days after the first story about him came out. This is a guy who actually has a known alias of Sebastian Marcus. But the whole conversation really boils down to, you know, the headline question: photography contests, good or bad? And the answer really is, it comes down to, is it a reputable contest? You know, when you're talking Outdoor Photography Magazine Canada, okay, that is a reputable outlet. When you're talking Don Komarechka being on it, involved in it, and saying, yes, I've been contacted, I am judging, or I am involved in it, it's reputable. The pay-to-play part is not, to me, an issue, right? Yes, people get exposure from these contests. And there are people I know of that have gotten jobs from being in a contest. But there are also free contests. And really, it's everybody has to make that decision for themselves. What am I willing to trade? Am I willing to trade they get to use my picture on their website or in their print magazine to promote their magazine because they did the contest, but I own everything else? Maybe. But I'm not willing to give up a copyright for it. I have to retain all of the rights. Which then brings you to, what about what is your viewpoint of places like ViewBug, which ViewBug is not only pay to play. I can enter many of the contests on the free account. I'm limited how many entries I can do, but then they also have ones I can only enter if I pay. But generally, most of the award givers and judges are well-known, respected people.
Yeah. And so when you look at ViewBug, I'm on the fence about them because it is a company of photo contests. I mean, that's what they do. They're not resting on the prestige of a magazine or of an organization. I participate in, the PPOC or the PSA contests occasionally, and you can get, you can accrue merit points through these, through those organizations, and there's value in that, depending right. on how far you want to go. And if that's a feather in your cap for that, perfect. But a company that their sole purpose is to run photo contests and give prizes away for them, it just feels like they're not hitting the mark for me. I reviewed their kind of business model, and their terms and conditions were, at least at the time, they seemed fair enough.
They're reasonable.
I just didn't feel like it was worth my while to say, okay, I won a ViewBug contest. Well, who's ViewBug? Oh, they run contests. Oh, okay. You want a contest from a company whose sole purpose is running contests. So it doesn't have the pull for me for them.
The bottom line really is, you want to enter a contest. But you have a responsibility to know what you're doing with your intellectual property.
Yep. And a lot of people hide it in those terms and conditions. They'll steal your rights. I know of companies that will run photo contests with prizes that have those draconian terms just for a rights grab. just to get the rights to all of those images, right, so they don't have to license them, because, hey, they now own them all. And they got to pay out, what, a couple of hundred, maybe $1,000 in prizes. And Bob's your uncle, you know, that the winners are happy. The losers don't know they're not.
Yep. Yeah, totally agree.
Exactly. All right. So let's carry on to rights in a different direction. And I have a story here from it's also on Petapixel. It was written about by Michael Zhang, the editor. But Alex Wild, an entomological photographer, let's call him. He photographs insects quite a bit. And him and I have been in the same circles, but we haven't actually formally connected. And it's a shame because his work is fantastic.
He is amazing.
He makes me think, like, and I know how technically difficult some of the stuff is. Oh, you can't do that. There's no way that shot is actually possible. So, I mean, maybe I'll put a link to Alex's website just to check out his work in the show notes, because you should definitely do that. But he is suing a pest control company for $2.7 million US, I'm assuming here. Wow. You know, when you read through this story, Steve, he contacted the company and said, hey, you know, you're using my images. Please cease and desist. It was probably a lawyer letter and some money involved.
And we should mention it was 10 images originally.
It was 10 initially. And the story gets deeper from there. There were 10 images used.
Exactly.
And so then, you know, he reached out, like as anybody would, saying, hey, stop doing that. You know, the lawyer letter probably had some money in terms of a settlement. Hey, let's make this go away. Slap on the wrist, you know, Let's be good about all this. It's a business transaction retroactively here. Don't beat around the bush about it. And so then he gets a response and he says, I received the CEO, Zach Colander, says, I received your letter and did my research into it, Colander wrote. Quote, it does look like one of our outsourced content writers was taking images off Google. Internally, we have a company Shutterstock account and policy of using only that. I am working on getting them removed. Okay, that's good. I mean, a step in the right direction. That doesn't, solve any of the uses of saying, hey, you've misused my image, please pay for it retroactively. But okay, months go on, and Wild checked the website in January of this year, and he found that those photos had not been removed. They're still there.
So, But wait, there's more.
But first, I want to dwell on that for a moment. The CEO of the company said they're going to look into it. They're going to get them all removed. And he stated that. And months later, he hasn't done it. Okay, so now he knows that he is in the wrong. There's no question about that. And he just says, screw it. You know, we'll just leave that stuff up. Okay. But what's more is he discovered that another 8 of his images are now also being used without permission. Holy hell. I mean, from a content creator, from an artist, this just, it kills you. It makes your heart skip a beat in the worst way. Like you've just seen a car accident happen and you're wondering, I hope everybody's okay, but you know, everybody is you. And you're trying to pick up these pieces and say, okay, well, I mean, legally I have to pursue this. There's no question about that. And so what do you do at that point? Well, you contact your lawyers and you put in a claim for the maximum damages for each image of $150,000, because this is just awful. It's hurting his brand, really, at that point. I mean, to have this go on. And for 18 infringements at that price, the cost comes to $2.7 million. It is a huge number. I don't know if he'll get that amount. I hope he does. I hope he can retire early from something like this. But Steve, what do you think about this whole scenario and copyright infringement in general?
Okay. So when you sent me this article that we were going to discuss it, nightmares came back to me because I've had a similar scenario, as many people have. Couple things need to be revisited here. First of all, this time frame is key. It was February of 2017 that he sent the cease and desist, and that was ignored. A month later was a follow-up letter, and that's what the owner of the company or the CEO of the company responded to, blaming an outsourced writer. That was March of 2017. It was January 2018 that he looked back and found the original 10 plus 8 more images. So he is going after what's called statutory damages. So this tells me one key thing that I always want to stress to people. And I do now. I didn't used to, but I do now. At least in the U.S., register your images.
He has registered those images with the U.S. Copyright Office.
And he would have had to, because he could not get statutory damages if they were not registered. So if he had just done these images, found 18 of them, the most he could sue this company for, I call it the photographer versus the pets, the pests. The most that he could sue them for was actual damages, meaning what would he have licensed these for? They've used them for 11 months illegally. They've ignored him. And the most he could do is charge them what he would have charged them to begin with.
Yep.
The fact that he registered them, he can now go after statutory damages, $150,000 per image, $2.7 million. Will he get it? Probably not, but my guess is he's going to get a huge, large chunk.
Yes. Well, I know a lot of companies will have like a $2 million liability insurance, and I'm not sure if that will pay out something like this, but there's a possibility for that. We should say neither of us are lawyers, but we've talked to lawyers, and we know a few things back and forth about it. I'm surprised, actually, that there are no punitive damages being requested here, because, you know, this is clearly ripe for some sort of punitive remuneration, because he told them, the use, as you said, this has been a long going thing, and they refused to stop illegally using his images. But regardless of what he comes down to out of something like this, I think that this has to be something that every photographer does, is register the copyright. Now, if you don't live in the US, you can still register your copyright.
And you should.
With the US Copyright Office. And in some cases, I've heard, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but if all of those images were registered at once, a defense lawyer might argue that that constitutes only a single infringement because they are registered in a single batch. In the US, I believe it's either $35 or $50. I can't remember the exact numbers, but
a registration is $55. Right. And what you just said actually is key. Everybody is upset that just February 20th or 21st, the Copyright Office changed the registration system for unpublished images. And the reason they did was the defense that you just mentioned. People were saying they were registered as a batch. And when you registered unpublished images, you did not have to name each individual image. You could just name the batch. And that's been used as a defense. Now, I think any good attorney can probably get around it, but they did this to clarify. But I want to interject one thing. If you do not live in the U.S., wherever you're listening to this at, or, you know, Don's in Canada, the odds of your images in an internet world being infringed in another country are high. The odds of that other country being the United States are extremely high. You do not have to be a resident. Over the internet, you can register your images with the U.S. Copyright Office and get the full protections of a registered copyright in the Yes. U.S. if it's infringed in the
Now,
U.S.
Now, there's also international conventions like the Berne Convention that allows for one country's copyright regulations and authorities to at least carry on to another country in some structure.
Right.
But I mean, that can be a total legal gray area. Just register your images in the US. I've registered a few of my images in Canada as well with the Canadian Intellectual Property Office. In Canada, it costs $50 to register a single image. Somebody had mentioned to me that you can register them as a batch, but I've never found any proof of that. I hope that you can. But I've registered a few key images in both countries just to double up and be very secure about some of my best work. And yeah, it's going to cost you money to do that, and you're not going to get anything back until somebody steals your photos. But if they do, then it's so much more in your favor to have this. And again, you can upload a ton of photographs. You've got to label the file names and the date taken or the date published and all this information, but it's worth it. You know, set aside a day of your life, you know, grab a beer, go through your photos, start just randomly throwing stuff into that Excel spreadsheet to get all those numbers to match up and make that registration happen. Because if you're not doing that, if somebody comes and infringes on your rights, you have very little to defend yourself about. Now, I've had two settlements in the US, and of course, we can't discuss the actual specifics of it. They've been settled. They did not go to court. But the image in question was registered with the US Copyright Office. And that is the only reason why my lawyer was able to take those cases on contingency. So it didn't even cost me anything to have the lawyer pursue this, because they knew that the payout at the end of the day for their effort was going to be worth their while. They didn't have to start nickel and diming me for writing letters. And so as a photographer, to defend your work, it now doesn't cost you anything to retain a lawyer if you get the right one.
Well, and in my particular instance, there was a well-known music magazine in Spain. They stole two of my images of Paul Stanley, as in Paul Stanley of Kiss. And they readily admitted that they did it. And their comment to me was, oh, it was the last editor. He's been fired, but you can look him up on Facebook. He'll be liable for it. No. The magazine infringed. I hired an attorney in Spain. And this is where it gets weird, is other countries are different. Spain sent letters. This company changed hands 5 times in a year, making anybody claiming responsibility difficult. So I would have had to take the original company to court. They went into receivership. But in Spain, the lawyers won't do it on a contingency. So I would have had to pony up money whether I win or lose. But I did hire the lawyer, and I did go after it. One of the most interesting episodes I did of my podcast was with Ed Greenberg and Jack Resnicki of The Copyright Zone. They wrote the book, The Copyright Zone. Those two together are comedy. It's so good. But they spent an hour and a half with me talking about copyright for photographers, and it was so enlightening. This photographer, whose name just slips me now, Alex?
Oh, Alex Wilde.
Alex Wilde. There's a link in that article to his copyright infringement strategy. And one of the, he does a question answer in his copyright. I love this. Question: what if I just remove the image, right? Which is what the guy basically said he's going to do. I probably shouldn't tell you this since it's a legalish advice thing and I'm not a lawyer. And since it's against my financial interest to tell you, but if you plan to deal with the letter by ignoring it, you may be best off not removing the image at all. If you remove it after receiving the notice, then the legal team can assume that you've knowingly chosen to try and duck the fees. And should we end up in court, you're now talking willful infringement. This, if you do nothing else from this article, go read the copyright enforcement strategy that he has, because it's
phenomenal. Is wonderful. And everybody should have a strategy for this. You know, he probably pursues, copyright infringements from a number of different sources where, like, to locate them anyhow. I use Google Images, Bing Images, TinEye, Image Rights International, and a few other sources where I can find images from. I know that Alex also uses Image Rights, and I'm using them a little bit less now because their rules are that if they find the infringement first, then they get first dibs on pursuing it. And unless they give up on that, you can't go to a lawyer anywhere else and pursue that with other means. So there was a magazine, I think, in the UK that there was two infringements from them that Image Rights had taken on and just disappeared. Like, I mean, maybe they sent out some demand letters. They didn't get anything back. I don't get the whole dossier. And so Image Rights has the exclusive rights on that, even though they're doing nothing with it. And then finally, they closed the case saying, hey, you can pursue this with somebody else. But that was a year and a half later. And so then I talked to a couple of UK lawyers, and all of them wanted a lot of money to write just a single letter. And then I talked to another guy who, again, I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice. But you can take these people to small claims court, and you don't have to be personally present. You can get a proxy. And I've got some mates in the UK that could easily stand in for me as a proxy. And a lot of cases get settled that way. So I'm going to be pursuing it in that regard. But every country is different. And the fact that those images that were infringed were also that they weren't registered in the UK, but they were in Canada. And there are certain conventions that apply that carry that forward with some strength to other countries. So again, talk to a good lawyer, read up on this stuff as much as you can. You know, Canada has had some modernizations to its Copyright Act in the last few years as well. One of them that I found quite useful is that a watermark on an image is considered, the Canadian term is rights management information. And that means that if you remove that, like if you crop it out, you are knowingly removing rights management information, like removing that big do not pirate this video and all the credits on the beginning of ending of a movie. Well, you're circumventing all of those measures. And then, or you say pirating a video game, and it's meant to cover all of these rights management issues. And so photographers can maintain that with a watermark on their photos to some greater degree. I'm not sure exactly how that boils down to the remedies and the legal process, but I, when I'm uploading on some services, put a very small, very faint watermark in the photo, and in the back end, in the EXIF data, in the metadata, I put all of my contact information, you know, not my physical address, but my phone number and email address. If people want to get in touch and license something, that information is there. So seek it out. And if you don't, well, that hurts you at the end.
Well, and that copyright management information is the metadata that's embedded in the image. But that's one of the, you know, how many times have we as photographers been in that argument with somebody about should you watermark or should you not? It ruins the image. The thing about watermarking is, A, I've licensed images because people found me because it was on there. But it doesn't mean it has to be across the middle of the image and ruin the image. Make it tasteful, make it small, put it in a corner somewhere. But in the US, it's the same thing. If, and again, not an attorney, but I'm going off what I've researched in the episode I did with Ed and Jack. If you've got the watermark on there and somebody knowingly removes it, whether it be in Photoshop, cropping, whatever, it shows willful infringement because you knew it was their image and you took that out to use it. So the main thing is understand what your rights are. That's really what it comes down to, is it's your intellectual property and it can be too late. You can always register images, for example, after the fact, but you will limit how much you can get if you have to go after somebody that infringes you.
Yeah, I have two or three images that are infringed on quite regularly. And for the first few of them, the images were not registered. I registered the images as soon as I saw this being an issue. And then anybody that infringes after the registration, then they get the full hammer.
Yeah, and the key is, you know, Don said it a second ago, talk to a real attorney, not the ones who play it on this podcast. Talk to a real, and the key is, you have a brother-in-law that's a real estate attorney that happened to take an IP class in law school. No. Talk to an actual IP attorney that is local to you that specializes in intellectual property.
Exactly. All right. I think we put the pin in that one pretty well. So let's move on to our final story, which I like to kind of end episodes whenever one of these come out, that show kind of the far field future of photography. And this one is, NVIDIA's AI can magically transfer one photograph's quote unquote style into another. And so in the title image from this Petapixel article, although I tried to trace this back down to its original source, and it wasn't nearly as beautiful as the Petapixel. So the first image is a house, lots of beautiful glass in the front. It's illuminated inside. It's a glowing yellow color with a sky, very dark blue sky. So this is night or dusk. And then you try to take that style and apply it to, I think it's the Louvre in France, in Paris. And it does a magical job of transferring that daylight picture from Paris to the exact same nighttime style of the first photograph. Now, it's not perfect, and the resolution, I'm sure, is quite low. And they do a lot of different comparisons with other AI algorithms that have varying successes. This is the best from NVIDIA right now. And I was shocked as to how good this was in certain, these are cherry picked scenarios for sure. I mean, you can guarantee that. But this is open source software. If you wanted to, it's Linux, of course. So if you are a total geek, you want to compile this yourself and calculate all the dependencies and whatever else, which I should really get back to my Linux workflow. I dabble in it occasionally. And this is exactly the thing that makes me dabble in it more often. This is magic. I mean, this is beyond what I would have expected an algorithm to generate. What is your take on this, Steve?
This is actually really fascinating to me. It's called fast photo style. And you mentioned that there are other AI algorithms that do this type of a thing. But in tests, this is, again, open source, right? Open source. It's 60 times faster than the other methods. And apparently they did like an A-B comparison with certain random humans, and humans preferred this method twice as much in the result. So that's interesting to me. But in looking at the pictures, and you almost kind of have to pull up the Petapixel article. Boy, it's a lot of Petapixel today. The Petapixel article to understand what I'm saying. The Louvre Museum sky is a washed out, not solid sky. The house is a solid sky. It merged that beautifully, but kept the clouds from the museum shot. The grass that's in front of the house shot with steps, it took the grass, clearly grass, and kind of made it into a blurred, green, mossy-looking thing in front of the museum.
It couldn't quite make the match in terms of texture. It didn't have enough information to do that, but it made a proxy to that by saying, okay, the weird, it looks like it's winter, so it's probably a snowpack or something in front of it. It blended it and removes it. It doesn't keep the same snow texture. It takes that texture away and creates a new one out of thin air that somewhat replicates what grass would be.
And here's what got me. The house has windows and it's an incandescent warm light color, yellowy color inside. It managed to know to put that inside the glass pyramid from the museum while still allowing you to see the trees on the other side.
Yep.
That. Now, I will say this. The lines in the glass pyramid are much softer. It's almost like you just took a yellow overlay and put it over the pyramid. Okay, I'll give you that. Still, you kept the trees on the other side and the lines are still there. That, my friends, is impressive. And it left the people.
Yeah. And it left the people. And it put proper, I don't know if it's necessarily shadows or anything, but there's a light spill off from the building onto the grass.
Oh, yes.
And so it knows that it's an illuminated object and that it's spilling the light off into the foreground, which I think is just wonderful. It's a beautiful take on artificial intelligence and a scary one. But when I scroll through, one of them that really caught my eye is the infrared version. And so they took an infrared photograph and they took a regular scene and they turned it into an infrared scene that is pretty good. It's not quite the same contrast levels, and it did something weird in the sky right behind the main trees. It added an extra cloud that wasn't there in the regular visible light image. And so it's working whatever secret sauce it can do to make this happen. And sometimes it missteps. There's no question about it. But when I started looking at this tech a few months ago, it was nowhere near this in terms of fixing little mistakes. And it's getting better and better to the point where I have to ask you, Steve, when it comes to a photograph, does it matter? We're talking about like filters in the background. We're talking about, changing the bokeh and whatever else in behind an image. Does it matter that came from in camera or if it was done in an app? Does it matter that we're drastically changing one scene to be another? Is it a lie? I have to ask. And does that make it less valuable for you?
Can all those things be true at the same time? Because here's the thing. Yes, it's a lie. I mean, it's 100% it's a lie. But in the end, okay, there's a lot of tangents here, right? In the end, what really matters is the art, if it's art. If you're shooting a photograph to be art, then all that really matters in the end is the photograph. And whether it be in Photoshop, you ran a bunch of presets and actions on it to create a particular look that you bought from an online store somewhere, or you had AI create this surrealistic HDR-ish, whatever looking image, does it really matter from an art point of view? No, not at all. One of them's a lie, 100%, but it doesn't really matter.
But here's my pushback on that, because a lot of the work that I do is intentionally trying to show a way the world can be, you know, a water droplet refraction, where you put a flower behind a water droplet, it shows up in that water droplet like a lens. It's beautiful. The work that I put into snowflakes to make it as accurate to reality as possible. And there's a lot of Photoshop to get me there. There's no question about that. We've talked about it. But it is not a lie. And no matter how much I put into that, it's not a lie. And that, to me, makes it more beautiful. It makes the world around me more beautiful. But if AI could take an image that has a bunch of water droplets on it and accurately, perfectly replicate the refraction of a flower in behind, which, looking at this stuff, doesn't seem that difficult. It's a specific use case, but it can happen. Then is one more valuable than the other?
Yes. Yours would be, to me, more valuable. But from a more global point of view, I don't mean global as in the world, but a more helicopter point of view, let's take your scenario to the extreme, right? You shoot water droplet A with flower B in the same scene as a refraction. You get it in the water droplet. It's gorgeous and you're done. You then take a flower and a water droplet shot. Compare those with your shot down the road. Now, this is more advanced. You're taking two shots. The flower, same flower. The water droplet, same water droplet. Comparing those with your finished image. And it takes the first two and merges them on its own. Identical to yours. Let's just say that could happen. Identical to yours. I would still see the skill involved in yours as more valuable to me. Now, a real geek would go, are you saying the programmer that wrote the AI doesn't have the same amount of skill?
Well, exactly.
You see what I'm saying?
You know, and it's not just one programmer. I'm sure it is many.
It's probably many, many, many. And now it's open source. It'll be even more on top of that. The problem to me is, remember recently, was it a year ago or so, Adobe came out with the software that could mimic somebody's voice and create their own sentences for them?
I think it was a little longer than that. And that's scary because now we're a year beyond that in development. And from these recordings alone, you could make me say anything you want.
Exactly. And that to me is where this, and they've pretty much dropped it. You don't hear about it anymore because they realize the ramifications and back push from it. This is the same thing. What if you could make it look like, when this gets really accurate, that I was in Washington, D.C., in front of the Capitol building in summer instead of winter, but I was actually there in winter.
And you can change what you say, you know?
Right? These now become more societal issues and more ethical issues. I don't think the merging of the photos is an ethical issue as long as they're your photos.
So long as you're not trying to purvey it as documentary value.
Correct. Correct. But, you know, these powers could be used for many things.
Exactly. Exactly. And time will tell how the use cases for this type of technology will evolve as people kind of spend some time pondering, saying, hey, you know what? If we can change day to night, visible light to infrared, you know, fall to summer, as we see in all of these images, what could we do nefariously in our favor? And that's where I kind of get a little bit afraid, because as this evolves, and it will evolve, this is not a question, we will find people forging images or forging conversations or forging the truth by using this stuff that at some point might be indistinguishable from the original. And I don't think it's longer than 10 years off.
The infrared shot you talked about?
Yep.
There's a glitch in the water, but overall, and I love the fact they're willing to show these not be perfect, right? But wow.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's the definition shot, right? Is the infrared, then the scene with the trees in full color, and then they merge the two, and it's like, wow.
Yeah, no, and when we see that final result, we think, okay, as photographers, this is the important question. Do we have to evolve? I think it's an unequivocal yes, but evolve into what? You know, we have to ride the wave in whatever direction that we want. I want to stay sciencey and truthful and push those limits in some beautiful, wonderful ways. And I've been doing a lot of work with ultraviolet fluorescence of flowers, making the flower kind of glow from the inside. And it's been truly fun to do this. But what if you could take just a regular flower photo, apply that style to it, and negate all of the difficulty I go through? Well, I might even consider doing that myself if it gives the same result.
Yeah. Again, to me, it's what's your purpose? If you're trying to make fine art to hang on a wall, go for it. If you're a journalist, this opens up ethical questions, yep, right? This is the cloned sheep question. Yes, we can do it. Yes, technology is awesome. But there are ethical questions that every profession needs to answer. And in many ways, photography has escaped some of those ethical questions. But we always come back to photojournalism as being our stopgap, as being the thing that keeps us grounded, yeah, to me.
Exactly.
You know, I post pictures sometimes of concerts. Now, my outlet doesn't care that I'm 100% photojournalistic, right? They don't care that I follow true traditional photojournalistic rules. If I remove a mic stand, they don't care. I usually don't. I care. But they don't really care. And if I see an image and think, wow, that could be really cool art, I might remove lights from the background and make it a solid black background. But I draw the line usually at photoshopping people, because I still do see what I do as mostly photojournalistic. I don't want to tuck somebody's stomach in. These are the same type of questions here that we as photographers have to decide individually, unfortunately, and fortunately. Are we willing to go there?
Leave that silence in the air for a minute. Just because we should all be asking that exact same question and nobody is going to come up with the same answer. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Nobody at all.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't even answer it for me, actually. Again, if this would do what I do, would I
well, maybe you use that as a tool to push yourself farther and then use this as that extra leap into whatever the unknown is that you currently haven't been able to explore. There's a lot of possibilities there that we could use it as a tool, not just as a replacement for effort and skill. So
here's the question then. Is this just another HDR? Is this just another post-processing process? HDR isn't fake. It just expands the dynamic range, but it's controversial in some areas.
Yeah. I don't have an answer for you. we boil down to, everybody's going to formulate their own opinions. Eventually, we will have some sort of industry consensus. But right now, it is the early days. And I encourage, again, anybody listening to this, check out the Petapixel article in the show notes over at photogeekweekly.com, because you will be amazed. I hope you will be, when you see what happens here when this algorithm is applied to, again, probably cherry-picked images. If you have the wherewithal to load this up yourself and feed in your own photographs, I really want to hear about it. I want to see examples that break very horribly, because a lot of stuff will. But they're fine-tuning it. It's learning. It's growing. It's getting better. And as we, as photographers, we're doing the same thing. So I bring that to our final segment of this podcast, which is the picks of the week. And Steve, we didn't chat about this beforehand, but did you have anything as a pick, something geeky, something interesting, something that people might not know about that will tickle their fancy?
I could give you a ton. Every single day of my life, I find something that makes me go, ooh, ah. The one I would probably pick today, I was going to pick this thing in front of me that I've started using, the Elgato Stream Deck, but I've got another one. And that is, I mentioned earlier to you, you know, the technology time that we live in, and the fact that, you know, I can just say, you know, hey, whoever, you know, set the scene to studio and my studio lights turn on. There are some light switches that I've purchased by Lutron called the Caseta in-wall dimmer switch. And one of the problems I've had with home automation is you buy a piece of home automation that either works with Amazon Alexa or Google Home or Siri HomeKit, maybe two. Rarely does it work with everything. So a lot of times you'll see one and it doesn't meet the technology that you're utilizing. These in-wall dimmer switches are super easy to install. Fantastic the way that they work. I've got four of them in the house now, and they work with all three. So if you're an Amazon Alexa user, a Google Home user, a Siri HomeKit user, they will work to let you turn on lights or, you know, set the lights to 40% or whatever you want to do at any given point in time with a command.
Wow. That's impressive. I just redid my studio and I put some dimmer switches from the same company, but it's not home automation style. It's not synced in to, because I have not yet gotten an Amazon device or a Google device or anything like that. I've been a little scared, I'll be honest. But I need to jump into that now because it's becoming so much more valuable in my daily life. And if I could see the lights on in the studio and I could say, hey, turn those off, you know, and they're off. Or if I could say, hey, if I'm doing a presentation and I don't want to have to, because the studio is also a classroom. If I don't want to walk over to the light switch, I could simply say, dim the lights and they'll go down. That sounds wonderful.
It's great. I use it. Now, if you're worried about a microphone in your house, that's part of the reason I like these. They work with HomeKit and the mic is not always on Siri. That's nice. Unlike a Google Home or an Amazon Alexa that triggers off of keywords the same way. But I've scheduled different areas of my house to turn on and off. So that if I do go to Vegas for a weekend, my lights still go on and off at a certain point in time. If we're sitting and watching TV and you know what, let's rent a movie on iTunes or let's watch, you know, The Tick on Amazon Prime Video. It can just be, you know, hey, whoever, set the family room lights to 40% and they all dim down and I watch the movie. Now, okay, there are people that would go, well, couldn't you have walked to the light switch? Yes, but that wouldn't be geeky.
Yeah. Well, and again, the use cases for this, as I just said, if I'm in the middle of talking and I don't want to walk across a room to interrupt a presentation, not only would it look really cool to everybody in the room to have the lights dim on my command, but it wouldn't break the flow of the conversation. And it's again, making life easier, which I think is a very admirable geeky endeavor that should always be pursued, no matter how tricky it is to set up to begin with.
Yeah. And really it kind of brings it full circle to your podcast in general, right? That word geek is in there. And really my mom one time wanted an iPhone and she's got one now. And when I said to her, are you sure you're going to be able to deal with an iPhone? Okay. Or a smartphone. Okay. And she said, technology keeps me young. And I've never forgot that. No matter what age we are, technology is your footprint in today,
yep,
as opposed to yesterday. The way that you stay in today is by using technology.
That's right. And to keep using it to say, okay, well, what is next? And grab it before everybody else does or before the majority does. And then you stay interested in always what is next, always what is coming around the corner. Tomorrow, the next day, we are going to have such fun in the years to come. Hopefully, as this podcast continues, we'll have more of these wonderful picks to talk about. So thank you for that, Steve. And hopefully you can send me a note that gives the exact model number or a link that I can put in the show notes. That'd be appreciated. But my pick is something a little bit more ethereal, something that I have been a part of for at least 15 years. Steve, you own a computer, right?
Yes, more than one.
And you think that cancer research is a good idea, right?
Yeah.
So what if you could use your computer to find a cure for cancer?
You've got me.
Okay. So Folding at Home is a project from Stanford University. And the Pandey Lab at Stanford University for many years has been using molecular dynamics to figure out how proteins fold and more importantly, how they misfold. And this uses computer cycles or GPU cycles. If you've got a fancy graphics card, that's wonderful for this. What it does is it uses Markov state models, which I akin to Plinko from The Price is Right. You know, from any one peg, it can go left or right. Then it hits another peg and it can go left or right. So you get a small section of data that you can compute in a work unit on your own computer that will process the molecular dynamics of a protein as variables change. Temperature, humidity, added solubles, electromagnetism, whatever variables they're changing, these different things will go one way or another. And you're going to compute a very small section of that. Now, proteins, when they misfold, when something happens that doesn't go the way that you want, that causes a lot of varieties of cancer. It causes Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, mad cow disease, and a lot of other bad stuff that we currently don't have any cure for. So if we can figure out what causes a protein to misfold, then we can find a way to stop that from happening and design drugs to specifically target the areas of those protein molecules that are affected by these variables. So with your own computer, you can download work units and let it run while you go to bed. Yes, it's going to use electricity. If you're not mining Bitcoin, you might as well be doing something with it to crunch these numbers, to figure out how a protein might fold or misfold from one step to another, and further the research that Stanford University is doing. And there's been a lot of distributed computing programs out there. SETI at Home is another one to find extraterrestrial intelligence. But I find the Folding at Home much more down to earth. And they've published a ton of articles on exactly what their research has provided, targets that have been identified for drug design. And I think there might even be some drugs in trials, or at least on the table for that at this point from their research. So if you have a computer of modern value, so something that you've bought within the next or the last 5 or so years, it can probably crunch some of these numbers. And they have
and it's a pooled computing, right? It's a coordinated computing where you're pooling processors with multiple people.
Exactly. So you do one small section and somebody else does that next Plinko check and somebody else does the next one and so on and so forth. But what they do, and if I understand it correctly, they do one major pass and then they create a bunch of variables that vary from whatever the entry point is to whatever the next one is. And they find what in aggregate causes a protein misfold. And they zero in on that and they redo that experiment and so on and so forth. You are in a team of millions of people around the world that are doing exactly the same thing on a bunch of different research. And I've got a computer with a lot of cores and a great GPU. When we finish this recording, I'm going to turn that stuff back on before we go to bed. And while I sleep, it's going to be crunching numbers for this particular service. And they make a game out of it in a way that every work unit that you complete gets you points. And the faster you complete a work unit, the more points you'll get. And they can be attributed to a team. And I have a team. I've had one for many years, team.com. It's the number is 34931. And that is actually in a sidebar on the Photo Geek Weekly website. You can see all of our stats and everybody that is contributing to that. It would be great if I had more people on board to show the value of the cause and their love of Photo Geek Weekly. But Steve, have you heard of this before I mentioned it?
I have not heard of Folding at Home, but what a brilliant way to use combined computing power.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've got very powerful computers sitting here idle most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the problem is it's always night somewhere. It's always day somewhere. So you may be using yours now. You can't have it on, but somewhere else it's night and somebody. So now you've got 24 hour a day processing. Yeah, what a brilliant idea.
Yeah. The fact that they can break it up into smaller chunks that are not dependent on the chunks of other people directly. That Markov state model is the key to this success, because if you had to depend on a linear path of computing, one computer has to do it. And that is the traditional supercomputer requirement, is it has to be done all at once in order. But this doesn't, because right. they're trying to find a break in the armor here and then zero in on that. And you do not need to do that in linear fashion.
No, and you made the Bitcoin reference, and that's much how Bitcoin mining is done nowadays, is farms of computers that are working together to do it. That's Bitcoin.
Yeah, and if everybody was putting their processing power and energy and electrical usage towards services and projects like this, we might have more cures. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been supporting it since high school, and I admit that in the high school lab, we had a program called Computers for Schools. And this, the high school was donated a bunch of old computers. These were Pentium 2s at the time that we were donated. And I volunteered my time to retrofit these computers, install software with educational licenses, and we gave them away to students that were going off to college or university that couldn't afford a computer. I stress tested them by running Folding at Home on them. So for 48 hours or so, they would crunch numbers. They would be like spinning hot. And if they survived that, well, then I got rid of Folding at Home to make the computer useful again. But, you know, I use that as a way to make sure that these computers were stable in every possible, and they all were. But I was using my school's educational resources in the early days of this program to help crunch those numbers. And I have no regrets.
Yeah, great cause. Really, really good cause.
Exactly. All right, Steve, at the end, I got to ask you one more question. You know, we talked about what you're passionate about, but in the coming weeks, months, years, where do you see yourself going with photography and geekery and the stuff? What is that idea that is in the back of your mind that you just haven't gotten to yet, that you just need to explore in order to be satisfied and kick off your bucket list?
That is a good question. That's actually a pretty tough question. There's a lot that I want to do. I'm not shooting as much as I would like. I'd like to shoot a lot more shows. I'd like to get back to having all access on a regular basis. I was a venue photographer here in Southern California for a while. And so I had all access to every show. I love that. I like to shoot for some artists. But right now, my primary passion and goal is going to be trying to get the Behind the Shot podcast kind of relaunched somewhere on my own. And I'll be starting from scratch and kind of building it up.
That's fantastic. And more power to you for whatever endeavors come in the future.
You were a guest, by the way. And if people have not gone to see that episode, my podcast, unlike yours, is a video podcast. You don't have to watch the video. You can just listen. But we dissect a photo, and we dissected one of your snowflake photos. And yeah, you got to go check that episode.
And we will make sure that link is in the show notes, because it was a really fun discussion. And that snowflake is a candidate for potential 3D modeling to end up in a in ornament form, to be a Christmas tree ornament in all full details. So,
The one we talked about.
It is one of about a half dozen that is in contention for that. So it had very clean lines, some pseudo-symmetry on the outside, but when you look deeper, the symmetry broke down, and it was a solid design. So I think that one is, it's possible that it will be there. I'm not certain yet. We're still deciding, and I'm still deciding whether or not I'm going to do these yearly or every other year, because they are very expensive to model in 3D. But that's as my snowflake series has ended for the year, I'm picking up all of these different balls and starting to juggle them again. And the ideas that are coming to my head right now, some of them I can't talk about and I really want to, but they're going to be fun. And so
when you do these in 3D, they're fully the full 3D snowflake to scale.
Yeah, well, larger than scale, of course, but
oh, I mean, but still to scale though.
Exactly. So the first time I did this was last year, and it is a crowdfunding campaign where people could buy that snowflake in either white or clear plastic or in sterling silver. And my God, the sterling silver one is so beautiful. But what you have to do in that case is, in the first one, I modeled the snowflake by photographing it on the front and the back. So I knew what was on the first surface, on the rear surface, and knowing the physics of all this, what's in between. And then we made a 3D model that not only had all of the surface details on both sides, but the details internal to the snowflake. And on the clear version, all of those internal bubbles and cavities are there and visible because it's 3D printed and you can do that. So it turned out phenomenal. I was thrilled with the results. There were production difficulties. It was not an easy project, but it's one that has left me inspired with all the knowledge from that first one to do it again and to do it even better. So that is on the table for the next year for me, and I'm excited to see what will come of that. So, yeah.
When you do that, I'm just curious. Now you've intrigued me. What kind of a run do you do?
Well, it was a crowdfunding campaign. So with 3D printing, you print whatever the number is that are ordered. And the more that you have, the lower the cost is per unit. So that's great. But there was issues in a lot of the ornaments, especially the clear ones, breaking either on their way to me or to other people. So I need to revise that. I'm thinking of possibly doing injection molding for those, but that removes the ability to have internal details. So I'm kind of weighing the odds here to see what's going to be economical and figure out what's going to work best to make the project come to life again for another year. The 3D printing in sterling silver was beautiful. The detail was phenomenal. But all of the 3D printing services that are printing in other metals, like steel or pewter or nickel, they are less detailed in that same production workflow. And so the model was unaccepted by all the automated checks. So I'm going to try to work with somebody local to me who is a jewelry designer that can help me make very accurate molds for other precious metals that might cost less than sterling silver. So again, lots of wheels in motion on that one.
Wow.
I have to remind myself at some point that I'm a photographer. I'm not a jewelry designer, but I still love creating this artwork in many different mediums. And that is a vastly different medium than I ever thought that I would explore.
Well, you give people a window into a world that they can't see or usually can't see. You're bringing that to life in just a different way, really.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad to do that. That makes me passionate about what I do. It not only keeps me interested in my work, but thankfully it pays the bills. So to everybody that has been listening to this podcast, thank you for helping me build this audience. We are, some episodes are, or on a weekly basis, we get about 2,000 downloads. And it continues to grow from there. Share the word. Get your friends interested if they would like this kind of a conversation. You can find all those details for subscribing at photogeekweekly.com. But Steve, where can people find you? Let's sign off on that.
Well, the podcast, and again, the past episodes at least, are at thisweekinphoto.com. And I don't know where the podcast will land, but you can follow me on social media. It's Steve Brazel on Instagram or Twitter. It's like Brazil, but two L's. And Steve Brazel Photography on Facebook. And then the website is stevebrazel.com.
All right. And we will put all those links in the show notes so that people can follow you specifically, not only for your podcast, but the work that you do and the geekery that you bring to the table, because this has been a great conversation. I'm sorry that I've been losing my voice the whole time. It has been slowly degrading as the conversation goes down, as my family is recovering from this weird throat thing that has knocked us out of commission. You know, we went to the spa today to try and recover from this, and I've got a pinched nerve in my back. All of that is right here, right now, at the end of this podcast, and I've pulled through it. So thank you all for listening and getting through the conversation as well.
I hope you feel better soon, my friend.
I hope so, too. And I hope very soon that I have the opportunity to get out and shoot.